Chapter 11. How to Close a Talk. The conclusion, too, has definite work to perform. It rounds out the talk. It holds the audience's earnest attention for a brief moment on the speech as a whole. It draws the thread of thought together. It binds and finishes the fabric of the speech. Definitely plan and word your conclusion. Never break off your speech awkwardly and hurriedly, with a mumbled, "I guess that's all I have to say." Complete your task and let the audience know it is complete. From Platform Speaking by George Roland Collins. The clock has nothing to do with the length of a sermon, nothing whatever. A long sermon is a sermon that seems long, and the short sermon is the one that ends while people are still wishing for more. It may have lasted only 20 minutes, or it may have lasted for an hour and a half. If it leaves the people wishing for more, they do not know nor care what the clock said about the length of it. You cannot tell, therefore, how long a sermon is by watching the hands of a clock. Watch the people. See where their hands are. If the hands of the men are for the most part in their vest pockets, pulling out their watches to note again how long you have been at it, this is ominous. See where their eyes are. See where their minds are. Then you will know exactly what time of day it is for that particular sermon. It may be high time for it to come to an end. From The Art of Preaching by Charles R. Brown, Dean of the Divinity School, Yale University. Would you like to know in what parts of your speech you are most likely to reveal your inexperience or your expertness, your inaptitude or your finesse? I'll tell you. In the opening and the closing. There is an old saying in the theater, referring, of course, to actors, that goes like this: "By their entrances and their exits shall ye know them." The beginning and the ending, they are the hardest things in almost any activity to manage adroitly. For example, at a social function, aren't the most trying feats the graceful entrance and the graceful leave-taking? In a business interview, aren't the most difficult tasks the winning approach and the successful close? The close is really the most strategic point in a speech. What one says last, the final words left ringing in the ears when one ceases, these are likely to be remembered longest. Beginners, however, seldom appreciate the importance of this. Their endings often leave much to be desired. What are their most common errors? Let's discuss a few and search for remedies. First, there is the speaker who finishes with, "That's about all I have to say on the matter, so I guess I shall stop." That is not an ending. That is a mistake. That reeks of the amateur. That is almost unpardonable. If that is all you have to say, why not round off your talk and promptly take your seat and stop without talking about stopping? Do that, and the inference that that is all you have to say may, with safety and good taste, be left to the discernment of the audience. Then there are speakers who say all they have to say, but they don't know how to stop. They thrash about in a circle, covering the same ground, continually repeating the same ideas, leaving a bad impression. The remedy? An ending has to be planned sometime, doesn't it? Is it the part of wisdom to try to do it after you are facing an audience, while you are under the strain and stress of talking, while your mind must be intent on what you are saying? Or does common sense suggest the advisability of doing it quietly, calmly, beforehand? Such accomplished speakers as Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, Billy Graham, and Martin Luther King, with their admirable command of the English language, felt it necessary to write down and all but memorize the exact words of their closings. Beginners, if they follow in their footsteps, will seldom have cause to regret it. They ought to know very definitely with what ideas they are going to close. They should rehearse the ending several times, using not necessarily the same phraseology during each repetition, but putting the thoughts definitely into words. An extemporaneous talk, during the process of delivery, sometimes has to be altered very materially, has to be cut and slashed to meet unforeseen developments, to harmonize with the reactions of one's hearers. So it is really wise to have two or three closings planned. If one doesn't fit, another may. Some speakers never get to the end at all. Along in the middle of their journey, they begin to sputter and misfire like an engine when the gasoline supply is about exhausted. After a few desperate lunges, they come to a complete standstill, a breakdown. They need, of course, better preparation, more practice, more gasoline in the tank. Many novices stop too abruptly. Their method of closing lacks smoothness, lacks finish. Properly speaking, they have no close. They merely cease suddenly, jerkily. The effect is unpleasant, amateurish. It's as if a friend in a social conversation were to break off brusquely and dart out of the room without a graceful leave-taking. No less speaker than Lincoln made that mistake in the original draft of his first inaugural. That speech was delivered at a tense time. The black storm clouds of dissension and hatred were already milling overhead. A few weeks later, the cyclone of blood and destruction burst upon the nation. Lincoln, addressing his closing words to the people of the South, had intended to end in this fashion. In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not mine, is the momentous issue of the Civil War. The government will not assail you. You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. You have no oath registered in heaven to destroy the government, while I have a most solemn one to preserve, protect, and defend it. You can forbear the assault upon it. I cannot shrink from the defense of it. With you and not with me is the solemn question of, shall it be peace or a sword? He submitted his speech to Secretary Seward. Seward quite appropriately pointed out that the ending was too blunt, too abrupt, too provocative. So, Seward himself tried his hand at a closing. In fact, he wrote two. Lincoln accepted one of them and used it, with slight modifications, in place of the last three sentences of the closing he had originally prepared. The result was that his first inaugural address now lost its provocative abruptness and rose to a climax of friendliness, of sheer beauty, and poetical eloquence. He said, "I am loath to close. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot's grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." How can a beginner develop the proper feeling for the close of an address? Not by mechanical rules. It's too delicate for that. It must be a matter of sensing, almost of intuition. You must feel when it is done harmoniously and adroitly. However, this feeling can be cultivated. This expertness can be developed somewhat by studying the ways in which accomplished speakers have achieved it. Here's an illustration. President Bill Clinton, in a speech commemorating the death of Martin Luther King, ended his talk about renewing national unity with these words. "We have to make a partnership, all the government agencies, all the business folks. But where there are no families, where there is no order, where we have lost jobs because we have to reduce the size of the armed forces after the end of the Cold War, who will be there to give structure, role modeling, discipline, love, and hope to these children? You must do that, and we will help you. Scripture says, 'You are the salt of the earth and the light of the world,' that if your light shines before men, they will give glory to the Father in heaven. That is what we must do. That is what we must do. And I will work with you." This is how a talk should end. Everybody listening to that talk would feel that it was ended. It isn't left dangling in the air like a loose rope. It isn't left ragged and jagged. It's rounded off. It's finished. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. You have just heard, my dear listener, what is, in my opinion, the most beautiful speech ending ever delivered. Do you agree with my estimate? Where in the range of all speech literature will you find more humanity, more sheer loveliness, more sympathy? Noble as was the Gettysburg Address, says William E. Barton in his book Life of Lincoln, this rises to a still higher level of nobility. It is the greatest of the addresses of Abraham Lincoln and registers his intellectual and spiritual power at their highest altitude. This was a sacred poem, wrote Carl Schurz. No American president had ever spoken words like these to the American people. America had never had a president who had found such words in the depths of his heart. But you are not going to deliver immortal pronouncements as the leaders of our nation. Your problem, perhaps, will be to how to close a simple talk before a group of men and women like yourself. How shall you set about it? Let us search a bit. Let us see if we cannot uncover some fertile suggestions. Summarize your points. Even in a short talk of 3 to 5 minutes, a speaker is very apt to cover so much ground that at the close the listeners are a little hazy about all the main points. However, few speakers realize that. They are misled into assuming that because these points are crystal clear in their own minds, they must be equally lucid to their hearers. Not at all. The speaker has been pondering over these ideas for some time, but the points are all new to the audience. They are flung at the audience like a handful of shot. Some may stick, but most are liable to roll off in confusion. The hearers are liable to remember a mass of things, but nothing distinctly. Some anonymous Irish politician is reported to have given this recipe for making a speech. First, tell them what you are going to tell them. Then, tell them. Then, tell them that you have told them. Not bad, you know. In fact, it's often highly advisable to tell them that you have told them. Briefly, of course. Speedily. A mere outline. A summary. Here's a good example. The speaker is a woman who is enlisting support for a fundraising walkathon for breast cancer research. In short, ladies and gentlemen, the statistics I have presented to you prove that the number of women being diagnosed with breast cancer is increasing every year. Much has been learned already to alleviate their pain and suffering, but there is so much more we must learn. Our research is making significant breakthroughs, but we have much more to do. Your help by joining our walkathon next week will help increase the funds needed for this important endeavor. You see what she has done? You can see it and feel it without having heard the rest of the talk. She has summed up in a few sentences, in 78 words, practically all the points she had made in the entire talk. Don't you feel that a summary like that helps? If so, make that technique your own. Appeal for action. The closing just quoted is an excellent illustration of the appeal for action ending. The speaker wanted something done, which was raising funds for breast cancer research. She based her appeal for it on the money it would raise, on the pain and suffering it would prevent. The speaker wanted action and got it. This was not a mere practical talk. It was delivered before a group of 50 or so women gathered in a community center and resulted in more than 30 women signing up and most of the others pledging financial support. Chapter 15 will discuss in detail the problems that confront the speaker when he attempts to get action and how to solve them. A terse sincere compliment. The members of this group represent the cultural leaders of this city. It is your hard work that has enabled us to bring top-level opera productions to Wichita. It is your devotion to the arts that has led to the development of an opera workshop at the university and the introductory courses in classical music to the school system. We on the Opera Board are proud of you. We thank you. Wichita thanks you, and music lovers from all over appreciate your dedication. With these words, Burton Pell, president of the Wichita, Kansas Opera Guild, left his hearers pleased, happy, and optimistic. That is an admirable way to finish, but in order to be effective, it must be sincere. No gross flattery, no extravagances. This kind of a closing, if it does not ring true, will ring false. Very false. And like a false coin, people will have none of it. Closing with a poetical quotation. Of all methods of ending, none are more acceptable, when well done, than using poetry or a famous quotation. When the president of a Fortune 500 company spoke to the employees of his organization on the subject of loyalty and cooperation, he closed his address with this ringing verse from Kipling's second Jungle Book. He said, "Now this is the law of the jungle, as old and as true as the sky, and the wolf that shall keep it may prosper, but the wolf that shall break it must die. As the creeper that girdles the tree trunk, the law runneth forward and back, for the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack." Dr. Sarah Hill has devoted her life to developing programs to make the education we give our children more effective and meaningful. In a talk she gave at a meeting of teachers in Long Island, New York, she challenged the superficiality that permeates so many school subjects. After presenting cogent arguments to support her point, she concluded with these famous lines from Alexander Pope. "A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep, or taste not the Pierian spring. Their shallow draughts intoxicate the brain, and drinking largely sobers us again." If you will go to the public library in your town and tell the librarian that you are preparing a talk on a certain subject, and that you wish a poetical quotation to express this idea or that, she may be able to help you find something suitable in some reference volume, such as Bartlett's Book of Quotations. The climax. The climax is a popular way of ending. It is often difficult to manage and is not an ending for all speakers nor for all subjects. But, when well done, it is excellent. It works up to a crest, a peak, getting stronger sentence by sentence. A good illustration of the climax will be found in the closing of the prize-winning speech on Philadelphia in Chapter 3. Lincoln used the climax in preparing his notes for a lecture on Niagara Falls. Note how each comparison is stronger than the preceding, how he gets a cumulative effect by composing its age to Columbus, Christ, Moses, Adam, and so on. It calls upon the indefinite past. When Columbus first sought this continent, when Christ suffered on the cross, when Moses led Israel through the Red Sea, nay, even when Adam first came from the hands of his Maker, then, as now, Niagara was roaring here. The eyes of that species of extinct giants whose bones fill the mounds of America have gazed on Niagara as ours do now. Contemporary with the race of man, and older than the first man, Niagara is as strong and fresh today as 10,000 years ago. The mammoth and mastodon, so long dead that fragments of their monstrous bones alone testify that they ever lived, have gazed on Niagara in that long, long time, never still for a moment, never dried, never frozen, never slept, never rested. Wendell Phillips, one of the principal anti-slavery orators in pre-Civil War America, employed this self-same technique in his address on Toussaint Louverture, the leader of the slave revolt in Haiti against France in the early 1800s, and who was later lured to France by Napoleon and there imprisoned and killed. Toussaint is almost forgotten today in most of the world, but in the 19th century he was looked upon as a hero, not only in Haiti, but particularly among the abolitionists in the United States. The close of it I shall give you in just a moment. This election is often cited in books on public speaking. It has vigor, vitality. It is interesting, even though it is a bit too ornate for this practical age. This speech was written more than a century ago. Amusing, isn't it, to note how woefully wrong were Wendell Phillips' prognostications concerning the historical significance of John Brown and Toussaint Louverture, 50 years hence when truth gets a hearing. It is as hard, evidently, to guess history as it is to foretell next year's stock market. He said, "I would call him Napoleon, but Napoleon made his way to empire over broken oaths and through a sea of blood. This man never broke his word. No retaliation was his great motto and the rule of his life. And the words uttered to his son in France were these: 'My boy, you will one day go back to Haiti. Forget that France murdered your father.' I would call him Cromwell, but Cromwell was only a soldier, and the state he founded went down with him into his grave. I would call him Washington, but the great Virginian held slaves. This man risked his empire rather than permit the slave trade in the humblest village of his dominions. You think me a fanatic tonight, for you read history not with your eyes but with your prejudices. But 50 years hence, when truth gets a hearing, the muse of history will put Phocion for the Greek, and Brutus for the Roman, Hampden for England, Lafayette for France, choose Washington as the bright, consummate flower of our earlier civilization, and John Brown, the ripe fruit of our noonday. Then, dipping her pen in the sunlight, will write, in the clear blue, above them all, the name of the soldier, the statesman, the martyr, Toussaint Louverture." When the Toe Touches. Hunt, search, experiment, until you get a good ending and a good beginning. Then get them close together. Speakers who do not cut their talks to fit in with the prevailing mood of the hurried, rapid age will be unwelcome and sometimes positively disliked. No less a saint than Saul of Tarsus sinned in this respect. He preached until a chap in the audience, a young man named Eutychus, went to sleep and fell out of a window and all but broke his neck. Even then he may not have stopped talking. Who knows? I remember a speaker, a doctor, standing up one night at the University Club in Brooklyn. It had been a long banquet. Many speakers had already talked. It was 2 o'clock in the morning when his turn came. Had he been endowed with tact and fine feeling and discretion, he would have said 6 sentences and let us go home. But did he? No, not he. He launched into a 45-minute tirade against vivisection. Long before he was halfway through, his audience were wishing that he, like Eutychus, would fall out of a window and break something, anything, to silence him. Horace Lorimer, the editor of the Saturday Evening Post, told me that he always stopped a series of articles in the Post when they were at the height of their popularity and people were clamoring for more. Why stop then? Why then, of all times? Because, said Mr. Lorimer, and he ought to know, the point of satiation is reached very soon after that peak of popularity. The same wisdom may apply, and ought to be applied, to speaking. Stop while the audience is still eager to have you go on. The greatest speech Christ ever delivered, the Sermon on the Mount, can be repeated in 5 minutes. Lincoln's Gettysburg Address has only 10 sentences. One can read the whole story of creation in Genesis in less time than it takes to peruse a murder story in the morning paper. Be brief. Be brief. Dr. Johnson, Archdeacon of Nyasa, wrote a book about the primitive peoples of Africa. He had lived among them, observed them, for 49 years. He related that when a speaker talks too long at a village gathering, the audience silences him with shouts of, "Imatosha! Imatosha!" which means, "Enough! Enough!" Another tribe is said to permit a speaker to hold forth only so long as he can stand on one foot. When the toe of the lifted member touches the ground, he has come to an end. And audiences everywhere, even though they may be more polite, more restrained, dislike long speeches as much as do those African tribesmen. So be warned by their lot, which I know you will not, and learn about speaking from them. Answering questions from the audience. Quite often, during or after your talk, the audience will ask you questions. As most speakers prefer not to have their talks interrupted, they request that questions be deferred until after the formal presentation. If you have depth of knowledge of your subject, you probably can anticipate the questions that might be asked. They usually pertain to matters touched upon in your talk that may not have been fully covered. However, you can never anticipate those off-base questions that may reflect the personal agenda of the questioner. By knowing 10 times more about your subject than you have time to include in your formal talk, you will be prepared to answer most questions. There are 2 ways questions may be presented. If you are conducting a workshop or seminar, answering questions is an integral part of the program. To facilitate this, provide 3x5 cards so that members of the group can write their questions on the card. Collect the cards after your closing remarks. The advantage of this is that you can scan the cards rapidly and select the most pertinent questions to address first. This also gives you a chance to think about what you will say before responding. Read the question aloud to the audience, and then make your comments. Make them brief. You don't have the time to give another long speech. If the answer requires considerable time, explain that to the audience, and if possible, refer them to sources where the information can be obtained. Another advantage is that you can screen the questions and ignore those that are trivial or perhaps too controversial. However, getting written questions is not always feasible. At many meetings, the audience asks the questions directly. In such cases, follow these guidelines. 1. Repeat the question. This is important because many people in the audience may not have heard the question. The questioner may not have spoken clearly or loudly enough. 2. Give your response clearly and concisely. Do not repeat what you said in your talk, but refer to it, and if the questions indicate that your original comments need clarification, do this by giving examples based on your experience. 3. Don't get into arguments with the questioner. If he or she presents a conflicting point of view, comment that you respect that person's opinion. Then state the key points you feel validate your viewpoint. And 4. Don't let any one questioner dominate the meeting. Once you have responded, you may allow one follow-up question, but if he or she persists in debating you, say, in a friendly way, "Thank you for your comments, but let's hear from some others who may have comments or questions." Occasionally, a member of the audience may become belligerent or heckle a speaker. Do not try to put him or her down with sarcasm. It usually only reinforces the audience's support of the heckler. Smile. Stay silent for a minute. Then turn to the audience and ask, "Who has the next question?" At most meetings, the chairperson will determine when the time is up and usually stand and say that there is time for one more question. Take that question, and once it is answered, ignore the waving of hands of those who want to continue. Thank the audience and sit down. In a nutshell, 1. The close of a speech is really its most strategic element. What is said last is likely to be remembered longest. 2. Do not end with, "That's about all I have to say on the matter, so I guess I'll stop." Stop, but don't talk about stopping. 3. Plan your ending carefully. Rehearse. Know almost word for word how you are going to close. Round off your talk. Don't leave it rough and broken like a jagged rock. 4. Some suggested ways of closing. A. Summarizing, restating, outlining briefly the main points you have covered. B. Appealing for action. C. Paying the audience a sincere compliment. D. Quoting a fitting verse of poetry. And E. Building up a climax. 5. Get a good ending and a good beginning, and get them closed together. Always stop before your audience wants you to. The point of satiation is reached very soon after the peak of popularity. And 6. Be prepared to answer questions from the audience. If possible, have participants write the questions on a card, screen them, and answer as many as you can in the allotted time. If questions are asked from the floor, repeat the question before answering it. Follow the suggestions presented in this chapter. Errors in English. Review. There are 4 mistakes in the following paragraph. See if you can discover them. Which was the man who did the deed? The evidence all pointed to Mr. Watson. I thought it to be he, but it was supposed by the others to have been them who escaped in the night. In the long run, it was us who were wrong in both cases. New study material. Rule. When a pronoun is the direct object of a verb, it is always in the objective case. In other words, if the verb in the sentence denotes an action that passes over to or affects the pronoun, then the pronoun must be in the objective case. For example, here's the correct usage. He asked you and me to lunch. And the wrong example. He asked you and I to lunch. Correct? The manager asked her and me to do it. Incorrect. The manager asked she and I to do it. Correct. I cannot say whom we will hire. In that sentence, the word whom is the object of the transitive verb will hire, and consequently the pronoun must be in the objective case. Here's an incorrect usage. I cannot say who we will hire. Here's a correct usage. A landslide hit their home, demolishing their house and killing both him and his wife instantly. Incorrect. A landslide hit their home, demolishing their house and killing both he and his wife instantly. There should be another change in this incorrect sentence, making it read in part, both his wife and him. This is perhaps a rather fine point, but careful speakers usually mention the lady first. Another correct usage. The school graduated us and our classmates. And incorrect. The school graduated we and our classmates. Here again, attention should be called to the improper use of the compounds. We are prone to use myself, yourself, herself when we do not intend to express reflected action or emphasis. You recall that this was discussed in Chapter 9. As stated before, this generally happens because we are not sure whether to use the nominative or objective form of the pronoun. Correct. The wrecking car brought the automobile and them back home. And finally, incorrect. The wrecking car brought the automobile and themselves back home. Correct usage of words. We think by words, and therefore thought and words cannot but set and reset on each other. As a man speaks, so he thinks, and as a man thinketh in his heart, so he is. G.P. Marsh, from Lectures on the English Language. Friendly and amicable. Friendly is stronger and less formal than amicable. A man who is companionable and sociable may not be cordial and genial. The first two words denote manner and behavior, and may be applied where no genuine feeling exists. The last two qualities imply a sincere and warm friendliness. Generous, liberal, magnanimous. Generous means giving freely and at a sacrifice. Liberal refers to the amount of the gift. If a minimum wage laborer gave $20 to a charity, it would be generous. If the United States Steel Corporation contributed $10 million, it would be liberal. Magnanimous means lofty, noble, raised above what is low and mean. It is magnanimous of you to forgive those who have wronged you. Healthful and healthy. Healthful means promoting or preserving health, as a healthful climate. Healthy means enjoying health, as a healthy man. Do not speak of healthy food or healthy exercise. And finally, honest and honorable. The honest person does not lie or steal or defraud. The honorable person takes no unfair advantage and may even willingly sacrifice for the cause of right. Voice exercise, developing resonance. The three fundamental principles of good tone production are correct breath control, relaxation, and resonance. We have already dealt with the first two principles. Now for the third, resonance. Your body acts as a sounding board for your voice much in the same way that the body of a violin or piano amplifies and beautifies the tones produced by the musician. The initial tone is made by the vocal cords, but this rises and reverberates against the hard, bony structures of the chest, the teeth, the roof of the mouth, the nasal cavities, and other parts of the face. This reverberation gives to the voice its most important quality. Think of the voice as a skyrocket rising up the diaphragm up through the darkness of your relaxed throat and breaking into a shower of sound against the nostrils and other bony parts of the head. Our problem is not to speak with resonance. You have been speaking with it all your life. You could not be heard 10 feet without it. Our task is to speak with increased resonance. How shall we set about it? Let me quote an interesting paragraph from a volume by Fucito and Bayer entitled Caruso and the Art of Singing. A great deal has been said about the value of humming as a vocal exercise. Humming, if correctly practiced, will develop the resonance of the voice. The humming of most people sounds like a caterwaul because the jaw, the lips, the tongue, and the vocal membranes are all painfully rigid. Of course, the vocal organs should be in the same position for humming as for good tone production. There should be complete relaxation of the facial muscles, the jaw, and the tongue, just as they are kept when in a state of repose or while sleeping. The lips are to be lightly united. Thus, the tone vibrations will neither be deadened by obstructing muscles nor forced through the nose by the strain. Instead, they will resonate within the nasal cavities and make the notes round and beautiful. Now, with a relaxed tongue, throat, lips, and jaw, pick a song that you like and hum the music of it. The first time you hum this, put the palm of your hand on top of your head and feel the vibration there. This is most important. In practicing all these exercises for resonance, let your first step be the taking of a deep breath at the diaphragm and relaxing the chest and feeling it riding on the breath. Note the open feeling that you have in your face and nose and head as you drink the air in. As you begin to hum and exhale, do not think of exhaling at all. Imagine that you are still inhaling, still feeling that open sensation in the head. That means open cavities to reinforce and amplify your resonance. Cultivate this inhaling sensation in all your speaking. Now, hum that song one more time. Place your hand, this time on the back of your head, and feel the vibration there. A third time, think the tone in your nose. Feel as if it were flowing up and into the nose, the same sensation as inhaling. Hold the bony part of your nose just a little below the eyes with a thumb and forefinger. Feel the vibration there, this time as you hum. Now, as you hum this time, think it forward on the lips. Place your forefinger on your lips and feel them vibrate. They ought to vibrate until they tickle. Now, hum it again in as low a tone as possible, and placing your open palm on your chest, feel the vibration there. Hum it once more, keeping the palm of your right hand on your chest and moving the palm of the left over various parts of the head and face. Feel your whole body vibrating, causing resonance. I have known singers who, when they hummed, felt the vibrations even in their fingers and toes. Singing is a splendid voice exercise in itself, so using all the principles of voice production discussed in these lessons, take a few minutes and sing the song you have been humming.